This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we feature interviews with Linda Wertheimer, Robert Siegel, and Noah Adams, the hosts of All Things Considered. See if you recognize this.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Robert Conley with All Things Considered.
That's how All Things Considered began its very first broadcast on May 3rd, 1971. The host was Robert Conley. We'll hear a report from that broadcast a little later. My guest voice will be more familiar to you than Conley's. Linda Wertheimer has been hosting All Things Considered since 1989. She actually directed the first broadcast of the show. After helping to shape NPR for nearly 25 years, she's put some of its history between the covers of a book. It's called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation as Heard on National Public Radio, and it features news stories, interviews, and commentaries. Before hosting All Things Considered, Linda was NPR's congressional and political correspondent. I asked her to share some memories of directing that first broadcast of All Things Considered.
Well, from my personal remembrance of it is of just being terrified. I was completely terrified. That the tape wouldn't get there, that everything that could go wrong would go wrong, that we wouldn't make the air, that there would be horrible big black holes in the middle of the program, none of which happened. But things were late and things were very rough, and they continued to be very rough for some time to come. But the first day, I came to work on a bus. There were beautiful flowers in Washington. It was a beautiful spring day, and there was so much tear gas in the air that you just choked on it because there were anti-war demonstrations in Washington. And it was a weekday demonstration to shut the Capitol down, to close the bridges and prevent the traffic from getting in and just completely mess up the capital city for the day. And that was the day we went on the air.
How did you cover what was happening in Washington?
Well, we sent reporters who, you know, untried, untested, unknown quantity type, quantity things. I mean, we of course, we knew them, and we had done pilots and so on. But it was, you know, this was the real thing. Reporters went racing out with tape recorders to try to get a real flavor of the day, to record lots of interviews, to record the sounds, to just speak into the tape recorders their reactions to what they were seeing and their descriptions of what they were seeing, to make it as immediate as possible. So that was the assignment. About six people hit the streets with tape recorders, going in all sorts of directions, and they brought it back. And then we tried to, you know, to slash and cram it into the program.
A line of young people is just come across the highway. Traffic is stopped. And here come the police. One, two, three, four police on motor scooters. One demonstrator knocked down by a motor scooter policeman. Anger now. Anger of the young people. Now here come more police.
Come on, people!
The demonstrators just told a motorcycle sergeant that one of his men did knock one of the demonstrators down.
All right, where? Let me get an ambulance down here for you.
Motor 3 on the Southwest Freeway. Have one injured down here. Could you send me an ambulance, please? It's right at Main Avenue.
And he hit the kid. He went right through the line.
He passed me and almost knocked me down. And a blue...
Yeah, but it's policemen we're talking about.
On a motorcycle.
Policeman.
On a motorcycle hit him. Not a citizen.
Right there, the man over there. Right there.
Sergeant, excuse me, Jeff Kamen, National Public Radio. Is that a technique where the men actually try to drive the bikes into the demonstrators?
No, it's no technique. We're trying to go down the road and the people...
How did listening back to this tape when you were editing the book compare to your memories of that day?
You know, what I remember of the day was the confusion and the fright that we wouldn't make it and concern about how it was going to sound and so on. But listening to it, what amazed me was that it's pretty good. You know, it's very rough and it's very it's confusing. But then so was the day confusing. You don't get a lot of details about names and times of day and that sort of thing. But what you do get is a very strong feeling about what it was like to be out there. Now, that's, you know, that's our stock in trade still. That's what we still try to do. And I think that when we succeed, you know, that's the best thing that we do, is just put you right into an event.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and as you know, she's a host of All Things Considered, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. And it includes highlights of 25 years of reports on NPR. I want to get to an interview of your own that you've included in the new book, Listening to America. This is an interview that you did in 1992 with Ross Perot. You did this interview because of something that you knew about from when you were covering the House Ways and Means Committee back in 1975.
Yes.
Tell us what you knew that you wanted to ask Ross Perot about.
Well, this was a story which was broken back in the 70s by the Wall Street Journal. During the course of a drafting of a tax bill, an amendment was added to the bill. It was a provision which enabled, it was a version of loss carryback. It essentially enabled a person or a small group of people who had large gains and large losses within a certain period of years to balance one against the other, to even out their tax burdens. You know, they'd get big deductions one year and have to pay very heavy taxes in another year to sort of average that out. Since it was designed to only hit a few taxpayers between a certain number of years, it was, you know, a so-called tall blonde man with one black shoe amendment, specially designed amendment. So everybody knew this had to be a favor for somebody. And the Wall Street Journal had the capacity to do the research. They just simply asked their research department, find me a taxpayer who has had huge gains in this period and then huge losses in this period. And, you know, do you have anybody that meets that criteria? And the computer came up, Ross Perot. So they broke the story that Ross Perot had caused to be inserted into a House bill an amendment which would have resulted in a multimillion-dollar tax refund for him.
So this is what you wanted to confront him with.
So, yes, because on the theory that some people have personal problems that don't bear the light of day, and that various candidates were having various kinds of difficulties with things in their personal history. So what I asked him was, do you think that the kind of, you know, piratical, although entirely legal, activities of big business are going to be any more palatable to the voting public than some of these extraordinary, items in people's personal lives would be. So I just wanted to ask him about his business conduct, essentially.
Did you get a satisfactory answer?
Well, he got really mad. He basically lost his temper, and we put that on the air.
Let's hear what he said.
I assume this is the sole reason for your taped interview.
No.
Your classic setup. So now that you have, you know, whoever you're trying to do a favor for, you've done it. And I'm sure you had a smirk on your mouth as you got me into this. And now that since you misstated it totally, and I have given you the facts on it, what else would you like to know?
I would like to pursue it further, but let me just ask you.
What is your show, anyhow?
All Things Considered.
And is this a radio program?
It is. But let me ask you...
It's really a radio program. You're not just somebody calling in.
No, sir. No, sir.
Now, do you want to know more about it?
I'm just wondering if you think that business practices may be somewhat more difficult to explain than, say, personal behavior has been to explain for some other candidates.
I'm not going to worry about it for a minute, and I just assume that there will be days when people like you show up doing a favor for somebody, and you've done it.
Was there any debate after this interview about whether his comments to you, is this a real radio show, should be left in or edited out?
Well, my feeling was that when you're talking to somebody like Ross Perot, or like the President of the United States, or there is nothing to be gained by editing the tape, and much to be gained by just leaving the whole thing there. Of course, so we didn't touch it. We didn't edit it at all. And the fact that he, you know, sort of leaped to the attack rather than answer the question, I thought, you know, meant something. And so we left it completely entire. Now, that meant that we left in that silly-sounding giggle of mine, that sort of nervous laugh. The person who was producing it did cut that out, and I told him to put it back because I wanted to be able to look at Ross Perot right in the eye and say, that's what you said, in case he came back to us and tried to claim that it didn't happen that way.
Linda Wertheimer is my guest, and she's edited a new book called Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. Linda, you grew up in New Mexico?
Mm-hmm.
Now, when I started hearing you on NPR, I just assumed you were from New York. Your voice just said New York to me. Obviously, I'm incredibly wrong.
Well, my family, no one in my family had a strong, Western or Southwestern accent. And I have no idea why that was, because they were all from the West and Southwest. My father was born and raised in Louisville, Texas, and my mother was born in a wonderful a town with a wonderful name of Loco, Oklahoma. And so we're Westerners for generations. But I went to Wellesley College, which I suppose, where they did think that I had an accent, although they thought it was mostly on funny words. I mean, I would say things like fixing to, meaning I'm about to. Or once I said striped. And I didn't say that again. But there were, I don't know, we don't talk very Southwestern, I think.
I know your father ran a grocery. Did you have to work in the store?
I did. I worked. I delivered groceries on Saturdays and worked in the store in the summertime. I grew up in a town called Carlsbad, New Mexico, which is famous for the Carlsbad Caverns. Well worth a trip if you're in the area. And it is it's not a very big place, and there's nothing close to it. You know, it's not like living in Evanston and being close to Chicago. It's 150 miles to the next sizable city, El Paso. And between Carlsbad and El Paso, there's not much. So it was a very self-contained place and very peaceful. And when I delivered groceries, I would just walk into people's kitchens, and if nobody was there, I would put their groceries, I would put the, ice cream in the freezer and milk in the refrigerator before I left. And the doors were never locked.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
Linda Wertheimer, she's a host of All Things Considered. She edited the new book, Listening to America, 25 Years in the Life of a Nation, as heard on National Public Radio. Our interview was recorded last April. We'll hear from Robert Siegel after a break. This is Fresh Air. We're featuring the hosts of All Things Considered on this archive edition of Fresh Air. Robert Siegel has hosted the program since 1987. Before that, he oversaw the entire news operation as the director of NPR's News and Information Department. He also served as NPR's first London bureau chief. This is his 19th year with NPR. Now he's editing a series of annual books featuring the best of NPR's interviews. I spoke with him last November after the publication of the first volume, NPR Interviews 1994. He's currently at work on the 1995 volume. Our interview was recorded before a studio audience. He told us how he got started in journalism.
I became bitten by radio. I loved doing radio.
This was at Columbia University.
This was at Columbia College, Columbia University. And I would do newscasts, but I would be a golden oldies disc jockey, and I would announce classical music, and I just loved radio. And I was always doing news, and that was at least the activity that redeemed the other activities, made the others seem somewhat plausible that I should be wasting all this time at the radio station. And then at the end of college, I was doing news at the radio station, and the Columbia demonstrations, the big anti-war, anti-gym demonstrations they were really, of 1968 took place. And we covered them round the clock, and I anchored the coverage. And
did you sleep at the radio station overnight?
Yeah, we slept at the radio station. And I loved it. I was absolutely bitten by it. But I hadn't entered wanting to be a journalist.
I bet that was an interesting education in a way, because maybe it was different in New York, which has, you know, the New York Times and the Village Voice. Where I went to school in Buffalo, we all felt when we were students, when there were demonstrations on campus, that the press always got it wrong. Their numbers were off. Their motivation was completely distorted. Was it an education for you to witnessed what happened and then read what the press had to say about it?
It was a very extensive education. First was the experience of saying something on the radio, and then an hour later seeing it come over on our one ticker, a now obsolete machine from the Associated Press, and then hearing our newscasters read it as though it was now news, when after, you know, 30 seconds of analysis, was this was what we had just said. It's now been disseminated by the Associated Press. The Columbia demonstrations were interesting also because first it showed me that when you live in a community, as I did in this university community, there's some things that were news and different. Like there were hundreds of students occupying buildings, and there was a threat of arrest, and they were about to be arrested by the police. And then there were things that were absolutely normal, like there were radical mime troops around the campus, or people wearing bizarre clothes, or posters. That was normal. And as the television people would arrive, they thought all that was part of the news story. they had difficulty distinguishing between what was unusual and what was every day. And I realized that there are things you understand about a story by living in it and by being part of it, and then translating it to people. You're either talking to people who are part of it or talking to other people. The big lesson for journalism was the night that I think 700 some people were arrested at Columbia in what was to be regarded as a disastrous evening for the New York City Police Department, a loss of control, and many people were beaten. Some of them I saw being beaten. And the New York Times went to bed early and published a lead that said that hundreds of students were peaceably evicted from Columbia University's Hamilton Hall, which was actually true. But then the other events that had happened after the Times went to bed were never quite reported or made it into the very bottom graphs of later editions. And for a couple of years, I saw people who actually were pretty sensible human beings trying to say that there had been this mass indiscipline by the police, only to have the New York Times held up to them to say it didn't happen. Many young stringers for the New York Times and even young staff reporters threatened to quit over the coverage of that event. But I remember David Suskind. Remember David Suskind?
Of course.
I remember David Suskind's show where someone was trying to explain that there had been police brutality at Columbia, and he held up the New York Times, and there it was. And the power of the press of record, people who established the official version of events, to form people's opinions or to help them rationalize their opinions is enormous, and it made a deep impression on me.
Did you go to journalism school, or did you learn on the job by doing?
I went to the job. Then I came back to journalism school, and
is that helpful?
Notorious dropout from the Graduate School of Journalism.
Not that helpful.
Well, it's helpful in some way. I met a wonderful man who was a mentor to me, the late John Patterson, who had been a great radio editor at CBS for many years, and a man who actually had lost his legs in the war in a troop train accident, and was a marvelous stoic Virginian from the Shenandoah Valley who could move enormous newsroom tables with one hand and a cane. But I also found it not what I'd become accustomed to in the way of university education. I thought it was a lot of, it was awfully anecdotal, and I also just wasn't, I wasn't much of a student.
We're featuring an excerpt of an interview with Robert Siegel recorded last fall before a studio audience. One of the listeners asked Siegel if he could interview any public figure, who would it be?
Instantly when you say public figure, I think about which leading politician I might want to interview, and those are so often the hardest and worst interviews that we do, that they're, I find them not attractive events. Most politicians I find are off on their own answers, and they have their agenda, and it doesn't matter what I say to them or what Linda or Noah says to them. They'll give the. Was I just saying? I can't remember what I've said and what place now. But did I mention Linda Wertheimer's proposal the other day? After each of us had recently done a prominent public figure who would have given the same answers if we had, you know, regardless of what we'd said. And she said, you know, I think in the future, Rob, I think we ought to ask these people, we should just say, have you seen the new exhibit at the East Wing of the National Gallery? Because just the same, they're going to say, the president has heard the message of the electorate. And then we should just come back and say, and what about the Redskins? Do you think they have a chance of doing that? And they'll still say, he's a man of the center. He began as a man of the center. So, you know, there are some interviews where, to be realistic about this, we're just not, we're furniture, frankly, in some of these interviews. And it's not a great ambition, public figures. There are some writers. This year I got to interview V.S. Naipaul, the novelist, who may not mean much to a lot of people, but it was a big experience for me to talk to him. And it was in the sense of talking to a star, it ranked right up there with interviewing Stan Musial the other day this year. For me, the somewhat talented harmonica playing Hall of Fame baseball player. Those to me are more satisfying interviews. And I guess if I could get an interview with the Pope, I would find that pretty interesting. In particular, having done some reporting from his hometown, and having been aware of what I think is one of the central roles of the past 15 years of history that we've experienced that he's played.
Robert Siegel is a host of All Things Considered. He edited the book The NPR Interviews 1994 and is now at work on the 1995 volume. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.